A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headache.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the IMF special drawing rights, what they are, how they work, and honestly, it's one of those invisible levers of global finance that most people never hear about until there's a crisis.
Right, the hidden currency. Or rather, not a currency at all. That's the first misconception. It's a reserve asset, but thinking of it as a kind of global emergency fund that only central banks can tap into gets us closer. Think of it like a super secure, members-only line of credit at the most powerful bank in the world. But the members are countries.
It matters because, well, we're seeing it matter right now. I was reading a piece in America magazine just last week. Christian groups and anti-poverty coalitions are actively pushing the IMF for a new SDR allocation in 2026 to help low-income countries. But hold on, I want to back up for a second. When you say members only, who exactly are the members? Is it every country?
If you're a member country of the IMF and there are 190 of them, you're in the SDR club. But here's the first twist. Your voting power and your access to this line of credit are not equal. Your share is determined by your economic heft. So the club has a very strict, and some would say unfair, pecking order.
From the jump, it's a tool built on existing global inequality. But you called it an emergency fund. Does that mean it just sits there, dormant, until the IMF declares an emergency?
It's more accurate to say the asset itself is dormant in a country's account until they decide to use it. The IMF can, and has, issued large one-time allocations to all members during systemic crises, like in 2009 after the financial crash and in 2021 for the pandemic, to flood the system with liquidity. But a country can also use their existing SDR holdings anytime they have a qualifying need.
Okay, so it's a permanent asset that can be topped up globally in a crisis. And this isn't academic. It's a live policy tool being debated as we speak. I mean, that push for a 2026 allocation is a perfect example. And by the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek Vi 3.2, always keeping us on our toes. So, why does this hidden tool pop up during every major economic earthquake? What problem was it built to solve in the first place?
That's the perfect place to start. Let's dig in. The core problem they were built to solve was a global liquidity shortage. Think back to the late 1960s. The Bretton Woods system was under strain. The world was running on gold and U-dollars, and there was a genuine fear that there just weren't enough reserve assets to fuel expanding global trade. There's a great analogy here. Imagine the global economy is a growing city. Trade is the water flowing through the pipes. Gold and dollars were the water in the reservoir. As the city got bigger, economists looked at the reservoir and said, "We're going to run dry. We need to invent a new kind of water that everyone agrees is real, or the whole system will seize up."
It was a plumbing issue. The pipes of international finance were too narrow. But wait, why couldn't they just print more dollars, or mine more gold?
That's the crux of it, as the anchor of the system couldn't just print dollars for international reserves without undermining confidence in the dollars linked to gold, the famous Triffin dilemma. And physical gold supply is limited. So the IMF created SDRs in 1969 as a synthetic supplementary asset to top up those reserves. It's an artificial bookkeeping entry, but one backed by the full faith and credit of all member countries. And its value is defined by a basket of major currencies.
Which currencies? And why that structure? Why a basket? Why not just peg it to the dollar and be done with it?
Stability through diversification. If it were just dollars, it would inherit all the volatility and policy risks of the U. The basket spreads the risk. It's a weighted basket, reviewed every 5 years. Right now, it's the U dollar, the euro, the Chinese renminbi, the Japanese yen, and the British pound sterling. The weight shift based on the currency's importance in global trade and finance. So, for instance, as China's role in trade has grown, the renminbi's share in the basket has increased. It's designed to be stable, deriving its value from several strong economies, not just one.
Which makes it a useful common denominator. A yardstick that isn't tied to the fortunes of a single nation, clever, in a dry, bureaucratic kind of way. It's like creating a unit of measurement based on an average of the world's most stable meter sticks.
That's the intent. It gives the system a shock absorber. When a country is in trouble and needs hard currency, it can exchange its SDR allocations for, say, dollars or euros from another member's reserves. It's not a loan with strict conditions, it's a right to draw on a pool of liquidity. But here's a fun fact about that basket. The SDR also has an interest rate, called the SDRI. It's the weekly interest paid to countries that hold SDRs and charged to those that use them. And guess what it's based on? The short-term sovereign debt yields of the basket currencies. So even its cost of use is a blended neutral rate.
The original sin, if you will, was a shortage of trusted assets. SDRs were invented to be a synthetic, collectively backed asset to grease the wheels. But how do countries actually get their hands on them? You mentioned the pecking order.
That's where the IMF quota system comes in, and it's the heart of the distribution problem. SDRs are allocated based on a country's quota, which is essentially a membership fee determined by the size of your economy, your openness to trade, and your economic variability. The mechanics of this process are fascinating. Quotas are recalculated every few years, but changes are glacial because they require an 85% supermajority vote, and the U alone has over 16% of the votes. So any major shift requires you.
The rich get richer, even in synthetic money land. The United States gets the largest share because it has the biggest quota. But let's make this concrete. What does that mean in numbers from the last big allocation?
In the 2021 general allocation of 650 billion SDRs, the U quota got it about 1113 billion SDRs. Compare that to the entire continent of sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa, which got about 23 billion. The disparity is staggering. But that leads directly to the biggest misunderstanding. People hear $650 billion allocation in 2021 and think it's cash raining down from heaven. It's not. It's a line of credit on the IMF's books. A country's central bank now has an SDR account with a larger balance.
They can't use that to pay teachers or buy medical supplies. So it's this weird thing, a massive asset that's completely useless for domestic needs.
Not directly, no. That's why they're not a currency. You can't buy a coffee with an SDR. A country needs to exchange its SDRs for a freely usable currency first. They go to the IMF and say, "We need U dollars," and the IMF acts as a matchmaker, finding another member country willing to provide those dollars in exchange for the SDRs. It's a swap. The providing country's SDR holdings go up, and its dollar reserves go down.
Which explains the limitations. If you're a small, struggling economy, you have this theoretical asset, but converting it relies on the willingness of other, more stable economies to play ball. What's their incentive to swap their hard-earned dollars for these bookkeeping entries?
That's one huge constraint, yes. The system depends on countries with strong currencies being willing to accept SDRs. Their incentive is that they earn interest on the SDRs they acquire. It becomes a low-risk part of their own diversified reserves. But in a true panic, when everyone wants dollars, could there be a shortage of voluntary swap partners? It's a risk. The other major limitation is that SDRs can only be used to address balance of payments needs, covering a trade deficit, servicing external debt. They're for international obligations, not domestic spending sprees. The IMF polices this.
Take that massive 2021 allocation. 650 billion SDRs, the largest in history. What did that actually look like on the ground during the pandemic? Walk me through a specific hypothetical scenario.
Let's build on your earlier Zambia example. Technically, it was an instant boost to the reserve assets of every IMF member. For a country like Zambia, facing crushing debt payments and a collapse in tourism revenue, it meant they could immediately convert a portion of their new SDRs into dollars to stabilize their currency and avoid default, without having to negotiate a traditional IMF loan with its attached austerity conditions. They'd contact the IMF, who would find a counterparty, say, Germany, to provide dollars. Zambia's SDR balance drops, its dollar account rises, and it pays its bondholders. Germany's dollar reserves drop slightly, but its SDR holdings rise, earning it interest. Crisis averted for now.
Which is the whole appeal? It's unconditional liquidity, at least in theory. No one comes in and tells you to cut your pension system. But here's my follow-up. In that scenario, does Zambia have to pay anything for this?
Yes. Remember the SDR interest rate, the SDR. If Zambia's SDR holdings fall below its allocation, meaning it's a net user of the system, it pays interest on the amount it's drawn. Conversely, Germany, as a net provider, earns interest. So it's not free money, but it's typically cheaper than borrowing from panicked private markets during a crisis.
But here's the rub you mentioned earlier. Because allocation is quota-based, the lion's share of that $650 billion went to advanced economies that didn't really need it. The G20 countries got about $400 billion of it. Low-income countries got less than $25 billion. So you have this perverse outcome where the tool designed to provide global liquidity ends up amplifying reserve inequalities. It's like giving the most lifeboats to the people on the upper decks.
And that's driven a lot of the current debate. There are proposals to channel SDRs from wealthy countries that don't need them to trusts that can on-lend to poorer nations. The EU just pledged about $39 billion worth of SDRs to the IMF's Resilience and Sustainability Trust, for example. But that's a voluntary, piecemeal workaround.
Which is a workaround for the system's original design flaw. But it still requires voluntary action from the big players. So the core mechanism, the basket, the allocations, the swaps, it's elegant in a textbook sense. But the real-world application hits the wall of global politics and existing power structures every single time. It feels like the tool is smart, but the rules for using it are dumb.
You've nailed it. The tool is technically sophisticated, but its effectiveness is entirely dependent on the political will to use it equitably. It's a financial instrument that can't escape being a political one, and that political dimension inevitably shapes its impact. The rules reflect the world as it was in 1944, not as it is today.
And that political dimension leads us straight into the knock-on effect and, frankly, the ethical quandary. You create this elegant liquidity tool, but its distribution mechanism inherently favors the strong. What does that do to global inequality when you crank the handle? Does it just freeze inequality in place, or make it worse?
It can actually exacerbate it, at least in the short term, in absolute terms. During a crisis, a massive SDR allocation is a tide that lifts all boats, but the yachts rise much higher than the dinghies. Advanced economies get a huge, no-strings-attached boost to reserves they may not even need, reinforcing their financial dominance. Lower-income countries get a smaller, though still critical, lifeline. The gap in absolute terms widens. But, and this is important, for the dinghy, that lifeline might be the difference between sinking and staying afloat. So the relative benefit to the poor country can be massive, even if the raw number is small.
It's a liquidity band-aid that does nothing for the underlying wound of structural imbalance. It treats the symptom, a lack of dollars, but not the disease of being perpetually at the bottom of the global economic pecking order. But if the symptom is fatal, you take the band-aid.
That's the harsh reality. But the practical implications in a crisis are still profound. Let's take a concrete case study, 2008. The global financial system was seizing up. Traditional sources of dollar liquidity had frozen. In November of that year, the IMF approved a general allocation of about 250 billion SDRs. Let's look at a country like Mexico. Not a low-income country, but emerging market, deeply tied to the UIT's access to commercial credit, vanished overnight.
A fire hose of synthetic money into a burning building.
For Mexico, and others like it, this was immediate, unconditional oxygen. They could swap SDRs for the dollars they desperately needed to service dollar-denominated debt and keep their banks afloat without immediately resorting to a full-blown, conditional IMF bailout program. It was a stopgap that provided crucial breathing room. It didn't solve their economic problems, but it prevented a liquidity crisis from turning into a solvency crisis.
That's the key distinction from a traditional IMF loan, isn't it? Can you give us a tangible example of what that conditionality looks like? What did a country have to give up in 2008 that it wouldn't have to with SDRs?
Night and day. A traditional IMF loan, like a standby arrangement, comes with a detailed list of policy reforms, austerity measures, privatization, fiscal consolidation. After the 2008 crisis, loan programs in Eastern Europe often required cuts to public sector wages, pensions, and social benefits. It's politically painful and often socially destabilizing. An SDR allocation is simply an addition to your reserve assets. You can use it without anyone telling you to fire public sector workers or cut fuel subsidies. It preserves policy space. It lets a government choose its own crisis response.
It's not just a financial tool. It's a sovereignty-preserving tool. A country can address its balance of payments problem without having its economic policy dictated from Washington, or these days, from a broader IMF board. That's a massive political benefit. But, and there's always a but, it's a finite tool. You hinted at this. It provides a liquidity bridge. But what happens when you get to the other side and your fundamental problems are still there?
If a country's fundamental problems are a bloated public sector and runaway inflation, the SDRs will run out and they'll be right back at the IMF's door, hat in hand, ready for the conditional program. It delays, but doesn't necessarily prevent, the painful restructuring. SDRs are for a liquidity crisis. They are not a solution for insolvency or deep structural issues.
Which means for true global financial stability, SDRs are a vital pressure release valve, but they're not a substitute for sound national economic policy. They can prevent a localized liquidity crunch from triggering a sovereign default and a regional contagion, buying time for calmer heads to prevail. It's the difference between putting out a small electrical fire and rebuilding a burnt-down house.
That's the systemic view. They act as a circuit breaker. By providing a trusted, neutral asset that everyone recognizes, they reduce the incentive for competitive devaluations or panic-driven capital controls during a crisis. Everyone knows there's a backstop, even if it's unevenly distributed. That knowledge alone can steady nerves. It's a psychological anchor.
The mere existence of the mechanism, the potential for a large allocation, has a stabilizing effect. It changes the psychology of the market. It's like knowing the fire department exists, even if they're slower to get to some neighborhoods.
It absolutely does. And that leads to the big, forward-looking question. Given this dual role as an immediate crisis tool and a structural pillar of confidence, what does its current design mean for stability in a more fragmented, multipolar world? If the quota system is seen as fundamentally unfair, does that erode the collective faith in the tool itself? If the countries that are supposed to rely on this anchor think it's rigged, do they start looking for other anchors?
If the countries who need the confidence boost the most have the least faith in the system's fairness, then the stabilizing psychological effect starts to crack. You can't have a global public good that feels like a private club benefit. It undermines the whole point. We're already seeing this with the rise of bilateral currency swaps between central banks, China with Argentina, the Fed with other major economies. It's a patchwork clubby system emerging alongside the SDR system.
And that unresolved tension is at the heart of the whole system. But for listeners who aren't central bankers, what are the practical takeaways from all this? SDRs can feel distant and abstract, but they matter.
I think the first, most actionable insight is recognizing SDRs as a crisis response tool with a unique profile. When you hear about a new multi-billion-dollar allocation, you now know it's not cash. It's a liquidity backstop being activated. It signals that the IMF and major powers see a system-wide shortage of trusted assets and are trying to prevent a cascade of defaults. So it's a signal to pay attention.
Which means watching for SDR allocations is a way to gauge the severity of a global financial shock. It's a technocratic canary in the coal mine. The $650 billion move in 2021 was a massive signal that the pandemic's economic fallout was being taken with utmost seriousness at the highest level. It was the financial equivalent of DEFCON 2.
The second insight is that the system desperately needs reform. The quota-based allocation. This episode was produced using DeepSeek V3.2. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.